Today on Annenberg Radio News, a new generation of musicians keep the mariachi tradition alive in Boyle Heights. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, November 21st, 2013. I'm Ryan Bouzion. Closing arguments resume today in the trial of Angela Spaccia, the former Bell Assistant Chief Administrative Officer. The prosecutor told jurors today that Spaccia could have retired with millions of dollars in benefits, but he said she cannot walk away from what he called a cash cow. Spaccia faces 13 counts of malfeasance, including improperly receiving $300,000 in loans from former Bell city manager Robert Rizzo. Prosecutors also accuse her of crafting contracts that allowed her to get an annual salary of $564,000 a year, plus benefits. Spaccia's defense attorneys argued today that she was just following Rizzo's orders. U.S. Senate Democrats voted today to change the rules on filibustering. This comes after President Obama has found his nominations have the legislative equivalent of a roadblock. Denise Guerra reports on why some believe the right to filibuster is out of control.
Usually the term going nuclear means something has become so serious that it's borderline insane. In this case, Senate Democrats say that the threat of the filibuster is so out of hand that their only step is to invoke the nuclear option. Or simply put, they voted to remove the filibuster when it comes to approving judicial nominations by the president. Now, a presidential appointment only requires a simple majority of 51%. President Obama explains,
"My judicial nominees have waited nearly 2.5 times longer to receive yes or no votes on the Senate floor than those of President Bush. And the ones who eventually do get a vote generally are confirmed with little, if any, dissent. So this isn't obstruction on substance. It's just to gum up the works."
Senator Joe Manchin, the third of West Virginia, was one of only three Democrats to vote against the rule change, saying in a statement that the rule changes went, quote, too far, and that the filibuster is a vital protection of the minority views. But according to UCLA political science professor Barbara Sinclair, in the 1960s, the filibuster was mainly used to block civil rights legislation.
The filibuster was never explicitly written into Senate rules. If you look at where it was used the most, it was to prevent civil rights legislation. Real question about whether you think that was such a good thing.
For most Americans, the thought of using the filibuster conjures memories of marathon speeches aimed to delay a vote from going forward. To prevent that, Gregory Koger, a political scientist, said some legislatures would use a cloture petition to block a filibuster.
One senator would threaten to filibuster, and the other senators would then say, well, okay, let's file a cloture petition, we'll wait 2 days, and then we'll see if we have enough votes to shut you up. But in the medium and long run, what that meant is that any senator could threaten to filibuster anything.
There have been 128 filibusters of nominees in the history of the Senate by both political parties. Half of those occurred during the Obama administration. Denise Guerra, Annenberg Radio News.
It was wet out there this morning, and that's good for L.A., where water is always a scarce resource. Catherine Davis headed out into the rain today to find out what's in store for the future of one of L.A.'s main waterways.
Mayor Eric Garcetti wanted to go kayaking this morning, but an overnight storm brought heavy rain, and the L.A. River, which is usually just a quiet stream, had a rough current today.
We couldn't get in the water, so am I a sad mayor? I was.
Instead of riding down the river, Garcetti took his guest, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Gina McCarthy, on a riverside stroll. They walked near Marsh Park in Elysian Valley.
So here's the water.
Okay. Wow.
The blue heron is just to the right.
This isn't the first time Garcetti has met with federal government officials to talk about improving the LA River. Last month, Garcetti took his ideas for the waterway straight to the Oval Office, asking for President Obama's support. The banks of the LA River were largely paved over in the 1930s to prevent flooding. But Garcetti says these days there are greener, more inviting ways to control the river.
The technology now exists, landscaping, the ways of moving forward to actually tear up concrete down the line.
but redesigning that landscaping will be no small task. After decades of urban growth, the river has become encased by busy freeways and development. In 2006, the LA City Council asked the Army Corps of Engineers to put together a study detailing what it would take to turn LA's cement river back into a thriving ecosystem. This year, the Army Corps proposed four plans for the river's improvement. Garcetti supports a plan called Alternative 20. It calls for wildlife restoration projects along 11 miles of the river.
What was recommended at the national level would do tremendous things. Unfortunately, it keeps too many places unconnected from the river. We want to make sure that people are linked all the way along this. This is one single emerald necklace instead of just a bunch of unlinked jewels.
Alternative 20 would take multiple phases and is the most thorough plan on the table. It's also the most expensive. It would cost over $1 billion, with the federal government and the city sharing the cost. After her walk along the river this morning, McCarthy spoke enthusiastically about Garcetti's efforts, but laughed off questions of whether she was making an official endorsement of his plan.
That's an endorsement of green infrastructure and visions so that we can work through these challenges together.
Garcetti knows the plan will take a lot of support and funding, but says one way or another, the river will get some kind of facelift while he's in office.
It's a wonderful place to be where we're all discussing how much money, not whether money, will come to this project.
As of now, there are still a lot of possible ways to approach fixing up the LA River. Garcetti says he just wants to be sure he gets it right. Catherine Davis, Annenberg Radio News.
The Los Angeles Auto Show will open to the public tomorrow at the Convention Center in downtown. Lon Murray got in a day early to hear what the buzz surrounding this year's show is about and to check out some sweet rides on display.
Jill is back at the Convention Center. This year's Automobile Showcase will focus on the intersection between automotive and technological industries. And today's event started by Green Car Journal recognizing the Honda Accord as the 2014 Green Car of the Year. Honda's Jessica Feeney said the entire Honda lineup features green technology.
In every model we build, we want that inherent greenness to come through, right? Whether it's class-leading fuel economy or tailpipe emissions. And when we set out to build a car, we don't think, oh, we're going to be Green Car of the Year. We just want it to just, that's just part of its nature.
Legislators had the green light today as well. The Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers named California State Assembly member Henry Perea and California State Senator Fran Pavley as California State's Legislators of the Year. Pavley, with Perea, produced Assembly Bill 8, a $2 billion measure intended to invest in clean air, advanced transportation, and clean fuel.
I just spent 2.5 hours on the 101 freeway, and I think we're making a dent in the kinds of cars people are driving. I saw Chevy Volts, and I saw Toyota Priuses and Hondas.
Also coming to a highway near you, the world's first full-size electric pickups and vans from VIA Motors, not to be confused with Kia Motors. VIA chairman Bob Lutz, former General Motors executive and a legend in automobile circles, says younger drivers will go for the new technology, but cost is a factor.
Obviously, affordability is an issue, you know, because while partially electric or fully electric vehicles will save fuel, but the technology comes at a price, and a lot of people don't want to pay that upfront price.
Autotrader.com is a main sponsor for the show. The displays are impressive, especially the new Aston Martin. The LA Auto Show is open to the public starting tomorrow until the 1st of December. Law Murray, Annenberg Radio News.
South LA educator Daphne Bradford was honored today at the White House as one of 10 local heroes who are, quote, champions of change. Bradford is the founder and president of the nonprofit organization Mother of Many. In June, President Obama launched an initiative to connect classrooms to the high-speed wireless internet. Bradford worked with South LA students and teachers on how to use technology for education, including the development of an app on health eating. South LA is celebrating a brand new soccer field at the Martin Luther King Jr. Recreational Center, and Stephanie Monti has more.
A class of fifth graders from Martin Luther King Jr. Elementary School in South LA led the Pledge of Allegiance and rushed to score the first goal on their brand new soccer field. The construction for this project cost about $650,000. The 80 by 130 feet swath of bright green synthetic grass has white outlining and two net goals surrounded by fencing. Outside the gate are two sets of new bleachers. 20-year-old Minerva Hernandez lives with her family next door to the park. She says the field used to be all dirt and made the neighborhood look messy and dusty.
And we talked about like how to improve the park, how they could make it better, and they actually listened. They took their time to renew the whole park and make the park a better place.
Michael Scholl from the Department of Recreation and Parks says the synthetic grass is a huge improvement to replace the dirt problem from before.
It's hard to keep the grass actually growing because of the use, you know, so this, you know, quite often on our turf soccer fields, we have to close them down for a few months to allow them to regenerate and, you know, grow back. A synthetic field, we don't. It can be used, 365 days of the year.
Last year, 18 new parks were built in the South Los Angeles area. There is an initiative to build 50 new parks next year through Proposition K, a ballot measure that was passed in 1996 for the purpose of funding parks. 8th District Council member Bernard Park says the cost of the project grew significantly, but will have a greater impact on the health of the community.
What I thought was so important when we first started the project is that when you look at some of our schools, such as MLK School here, they have no green space on the whole campus. It's all asphalt. So kids do not have a place to actually have a physical training exercise. So we invited them to use this park as part of their school curriculum, and they have.
The Martin Luther King Jr. Recreation Center is the 20th park in Los Angeles to have a synthetic grass field. Stephanie Monti, Annenberg Radio News.
If you're already complaining about how cold it is, brace yourself. It's about to get even colder. Tonight's temperatures will dip into the low 50s with light winds, while this weekend will also be pretty chilly with highs in the upper 60s and lows in the upper 40s. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we hear about how the legacy of JFK connects with today's generation. Between 1 and 300,000 children are sold for sex each year in the United States. Community leaders and residents in South LA will march against child sex trafficking tonight. Logan Healy has more about the rally.
Nearly 400 people are expected to walk down Long Beach Boulevard from Compton to Linwood this evening. The same route is often used by johns and pimps to buy and sell their victims, some as young as 12 years old. It's estimated that as many as 3,000 children are sold for sex in Los Angeles each year.
It really is modern-day slavery.
That's Steve Whitmore, a spokesman for L.A. County Sheriff Lee Baca, who will attend today's rally. L.A. County Supervisor Mark Ridley Thomas organized the march. His spokeswoman, Lorenza Munoz, says lawmakers are working to strengthen anti-trafficking laws, and she says tonight's march puts sex traffickers on notice that the community is watching.
What we hope happens is that people realize that this is happening in their community, that the trafficking of children is not something that happens only in countries abroad.
Sex trafficking is a $32 billion global business that's increasingly run by gangs. Prostitutes are just the public face of a shadowy, complicated industry. USC professor Annalisa Enrile says society needs to start viewing prostitutes as victims and not criminals.
The commodification of children specifically is reaching epidemic proportions, and it's time that, you know, LA really comes out as a community to stand against it and to begin to coordinate all of our efforts to ending sex trafficking, particularly of children.
Tonight's rally will begin at 6:30 at Long Beach Boulevard and Palmer Street. Logan Healy, Annenberg Radio News.
The LGBT population of California smokes at a rate nearly double the heterosexual population. Julian De Ocampo reports on a new campaign that aims to address LGBT smokers in LA.
County officials gathered at the 11 nightclub in West Hollywood this morning to announce a new anti-smoking campaign directed at LGBT smokers in Los Angeles. The campaign, named Break Up with Tobacco, will target bars and gyms with advertisements. Street teams will also be in and around popular nightlife venues to speak directly to smokers. Zach Bradshaw serves on the street team.
We're going to be on the street and in some establishments and bars and restaurants in the area, mostly bars, basically engaging people on the ground floor and putting a face to the campaign.
The campaign hopes to gain traction through social media by using the hashtag DoneWithYou on Twitter and Instagram. Giveaways will also be held featuring campaign-branded underwear, condoms, and lube. Matthew Scalarud, president of the LGBT marketing firm Pink Banana, says the giveaways are a strange move for an anti-smoking campaign.
You used to see condoms and lube given out a lot under a lot of public awareness campaigns related to HIV and STD awareness. But when it comes to tobacco, it seems like a completely separate issue altogether. So the connection, at least at first blush, the connection, I can't see how they put the two together.
Researcher Dorian Traub of the University of Southern California says the higher smoking rates can be attributed to where the LGBT community socializes.
The options that they have for places to socialize are generally bars and clubs that are geared towards gay individuals. And so what winds up happening is that because it's a bar or a club, often people are smoking in those venues.
Traub also notes that smokers may be dealing with stresses unique to the LGBT community.
Many gay youth have really increased stress levels, both because of the coming out process and because of homophobia and discrimination that they experience. And so that in some ways, smoking, like any other drug, is a coping mechanism.
Data from the California Department of Health reveals nearly 30% of the California gay community smokes regularly. This is almost twice the average for the state's heterosexual population. The campaign's advertisements direct smokers to lastdragla.com, a website that provides resources for LGBT smokers in LA to quit smoking. Julian DiOcampo, Annenberg Radio News.
Tomorrow marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Earlier today, I spoke with David Citrom, a professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. He studies the JFK administration, and we discussed how Kennedy evolved during his presidency.
I think the Kennedy of 1963 is quite different than the Kennedy of 1960.
How so?
In terms of domestic policy, Kennedy and his brother, Robert, who of course was Attorney General, were more or less forced to deal with the civil rights movement, the civil rights struggle. When they took office, they were very diffident about it. They were not really that concerned with it. They were much more focused on foreign policy. And I think this is a good example of how social movements can force political leaders into positions that they otherwise would not have taken. So in the spring of 1961, for example, when the Freedom Rides get going, the Kennedy administration actively opposed the Freedom Rides, tried to have them stopped. When you read about the March on Washington in 1963, they were not happy about that either. But I think the force of the movement and the embarrassment that a lot of these images were causing the United States abroad, I mean, these photographs and stories about buses being bombed during the Freedom Rides and the violence that attended things like James Meredith's attempt to integrate the University of Mississippi, and the general sort of image that being projected, particularly to the Third World, was a big problem for the Kennedys in terms of their Cold War agenda. And so they were more or less forced to deal with civil rights as a result of the upsurge of grassroots activism here, and the fear that the United States was going to really have a black eye in terms of the image around the world, particularly in the emerging nations of Africa and Asia.
What do you think President Kennedy's legacy should be?
I think Kennedy's legacy should be the idea that presidents evolve in office, that presidents have to respond to the force of events, whether it's social movements at home or international crises abroad. And we tend to forget that this is the case. I mean, I make the analogy with Abraham Lincoln. I'm not trying to argue that Kennedy is of the same stature as Lincoln, but if you look at Lincoln in 1860 and you look at Lincoln in 1865, you can see a man who clearly evolved in his thinking, particularly about the abolition of slavery, black citizenship, the blacks in the army, all that sort of stuff. No one could have predicted that. But, of course, the Civil War changed everything. And I think there's a parallel with JFK, as I said before, that when you look at the speech that Kennedy gave in June of 1963 about the civil rights struggle and talking about the moral imperative of civil rights and introducing legislation and so on, it's clear that he was a guy that changed, that evolved. And that, to me, is really the most important legacy of JFK, the growth in office. Someone who really began to care about certain things that perhaps he didn't care about as much when he first came into power.
Okay, I've been here with Daniel Citrom, a professor of history at Mount Holyoke College. Thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Have a good day. If you'd like to hear more of my discussion with Professor Citrom, visit AnnenbergRadio.org. USC will light the Olympic torch at the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum as a tribute to the 50th anniversary of the assassination. Kennedy gave his nomination speech at the Democratic National Convention at the Coliseum. Councilman Tom Labonge will light the torch, which will burn for 24 hours, beginning at midnight tonight. Changes are threatening Limert Park, an African-American cultural hub. The world stage is the arts and culture cornerstone of the neighborhood. And as Brianna Sachs reports, supporters of the world stage are putting up a fight to save it from extinction.
Drive down Degnan Avenue at 9 p.m. The little street in Limert Park will be mostly empty, but you'll hear something like this. Or this. Or sometimes even this. Those are the sounds of the World Stage, a nonprofit performance gallery founded in 1989 by jazz drumming great Billy Higgins and poet Camus Dayud. It's a cramped, one-room performance center with peeling paint and old carpet. The World Stage has become the cornerstone of Limert Park, one of LA's most historic African-American cultural communities. But now the legendary creative space is fighting a looming eviction notice and rent spikes after faceless investors bought the building a few months ago.
Hell no, we won't go. Everybody say that. Hell no, we won't go.
At a recent rally, scores of supporters gathered in the Village Park to fight for the stage and against what they considered destructive gentrification.
We not just want to save the World Stage, but we're talking about this entire area right here.
This is hallowed ground here. Nobody's coming to Chinatown telling them to get out.
It is a changing and dislocation of people. It's not just regentrification, it's the new colonization.
Supporters say the impending gentrification could erase one of the last surviving African-American creative communities in America. Mari Hashimoto, a longtime World Stage fan, says the city should recognize the cultural importance of the stage and what it has before it's too late.
It would be a devastation of colossal proportions if the World Stage were to close. There is nothing like the World Stage here in LA. It really cultivates the artistic soul.
The stage's artistic director, Connie Williams, agrees. After 25 years of churning out famous musicians and poets and preserving black culture, he says the area fosters a great sense of pride for South LA.
You don't see all of the gang banging and all of the other stuff that goes on. They don't come over there tagging that area. That's not to say that there isn't crime. I'm just saying I've never seen a community, a village like Limert Park in my life until I came to Los Angeles.
Williams says the true purpose of the stage goes much deeper than its creative offerings.
It's like a living organism. It's not just a building. But when there's someone hurting or some person that doesn't have insurances and they need a fundraiser done, someone passes away, they're memorial. Memorial services normally held at the World Stage.
Standing inside the old small room and feeling the music hum and twist around you, you would think you had been dropped into Harlem's Golden Era or New Orleans' Congo Square. The future of the World Stage could change a community. Many argue that it should be made a cultural landmark, or in a few years, its physical presence might become just another chapter in the historic neighborhood's evolving identity. Brianna Sachs, Annenberg Radio News.
In the 70s and 80s, the Boyle Cummings Hotel was considered their home, and 30 years later, the musicians moved out. But Emmanuel Martinez reports on how the hotel is still the center of this traditional Mexican music.
Mariachi musicians no longer live in the Boyle Cummings Hotel, at least not in numbers that resemble the 1970s and 80s, when four or five band members would squeeze into a studio apartment. The music's singular sounds still waft through the building, though these days they come from a conference room that doubles as a makeshift classroom. That's Nubia Gutierrez. She's singing Qué Bonito Amor, a song that describes love as a very beautiful thing.
Well, it's a love story. It's she's singing or he's singing to his, her loved one and telling them that, well, thank you about their love.
But love also hurts. Mayra Rodriguez expresses that sentiment when she sings El Columpio.
¿Cuántas veces te dije llorando?
It's about love and deception. That's what it's about. Like most of the songs are usually about that, being betrayed by your lover.
She sings a song full of heartache because we've all been there.
It brings back memories of some unpleasant experiences, but at the same time, it helps me let it out.
Most mariachis sing about love. Gutierrez and Rodriguez are no exception. But in the mariachi class in Boyle Heights, they are the exception.
Especially since I'm a girl, and there's not many females in this.
Out of a dozen students, they are the only girls in the class. And 23-year-old Gutierrez and 18-year-old Rodriguez are also the youngest. But there is no denying this is who they are.
That's in my blood already. My whole family plays it on my dad's side. My uncles, cousins, everybody plays it, and it's already like in their blood.
The music is in Rodriguez's blood, too. Her dad is also in the mariachi class. Rodriguez and Gutierrez have Mexican roots, but were born in the United States. They both say many Mexican Americans forget about the Mexican part.
We have a large group of Latinos and Latinas living here. And unfortunately, like I said, many people are forgetting where they come from.
A lot of the kids nowadays, they're forgetting about their sus raíces.
But they won't be forgetting about their roots, because the high notes of El Columpio and any other song in the mariachi songbook will keep their tradition alive. Emmanuel Martinez, Annenberg Radio News.
And now we're going to check in with Jeremy Chen to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News.
Thank you, Ryan. Coming up at 6 on ATVN, wet weather is hitting Southern California, causing headaches for drivers and students. We'll check in live with our reporter Joey Wang for the latest. And a group of student activists staged a die-in today on campus to protest USC's sale of clothes produced in similar conditions. And finally, LA Department of Health is launching a new campaign to keep Hollywood's LGBT population from smoking tobacco. All this and more coming up at 6 on ATVN. Back to you, Ryan.
All right, and check out our website for more stories. You can hear how USC students hold a die-in to call attention to sweatshop labor and hear what Filipino Americans in Southern California are doing to raise money for Typhoon Haiyan. It's all at AnnenbergRadio.org, and remember to follow us on Twitter at Annenberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining me on this Thursday. We had help from Allison Brett, Jacob Ellenhorn, Victor Figueroa was on the boards, Graham Clark produces our arts and culture segment, the newscast producer is the one and only Jerome Campbell, our executive producer is Catherine Davis, and for all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Ryan Bouzion. Stay classy, LA.